Hi, you are listening to the podcast Coach Teamet with me, Rickard Aspgren, and Andrew Plake, basketball developer at the Swedish Basketball Federation. In this episode, we'll be talking to researcher Amanda Wiesek. Amanda has for a long time been studying what makes sports fun and why that is important. Recently, she conducted a study on what young hockey and basketball players in Sweden think is fun about sports. Amanda, welcome to the podcast. Can you start to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am an associate professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. in the United States. I'm probably most known globally for my work in mapping determinants of fun across different sports. And I've been quite fortunate to receive both federal funding and funding from sport NGBs here in the United States and abroad in Sweden in order to carry out this research.
What's the importance is with fun?
Oh, it's a big question with some, I think, really important answers behind it as well. If we think about the role of fun, we know that it is the primary factor, right, that drives participation. And the absence of having fun is also the primary driver for why youth drop out of sport. So if whether we're talking about, you know, the sport programs on a local, regional, or national level, if you examine sort of the mission and vision of all of them, right, it's to grow and promote the sport and increase participation, because sport is a fantastic opportunity for children to grow and develop. Meet physical activity recommendations for their healthy growth and development. And it's a way for us that love sport and work in sport. You know, if the goal is talent development and podium medals, then we need a very healthy, large base of participants from which to draw from in that way. So it has very much athletic development implications as well. So really, if we're talking about trying to attract, engage, and retain players in sport, we have to become, I think, rally much more around this whole concept of providing experiences that are fun.
But how did you stumble across the idea to research on fun?
Oh, that's a great question, Andrew. I work in a school of public health and Department of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences. So for me, it was a challenge, I think, intellectually to kind of think about how do I take my sports psychology training and background and working in sport and intersect that with something of enormous public health relevance, that whether you are a federal agency that is really focused on health promotion of the citizens in your country, or you are a sport national governing body, right? What is the common goal that we can all sort of grab onto at the same time? And for me, that really sort of evolved around sport participation and looking at youth sport. And from an applied perspective, I had done quite a bit of work in graduate school as well, working in youth sport. You know, one of the things that we do in sports psychology is not only try and optimize performance, but we're really also trying to increase the quality of the experiences of athletes. And in doing so, also enhance, you know, athletic outcomes at the same time. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was an intersection of what would be a solution to both the public health crisis when we think about overweight, obesity, physical inactivity among children and adolescents. And then we also think about, you know, what is sort of the crisis that we're faced with in organized youth sport. And the prevailing challenge always in the conversation and discourse, and when you look at the numbers, is participation and dropout. And when you look at, you know, just general physical activity trends in children and in adolescents, it mirrors dropout in organized sport as well. Mm-hmm. So I really started to think about it both from a practical standpoint and from an empirical standpoint. We know there's so much literature, so much scientific evidence that shows us how critical the role of fun is. But what seemed to be missing was a very practical, meaningful framework that tells us as sports scientists, as coaches, as federation leaders, like, but what does that mean? What would be a way in which we could gather this evidence from players in a way that was very, that really gave them the power in which we could sort of, you know, leverage their ideas and insights? And that's really kind of the impetus and sort of birth of, I guess, what's known more globally as the fun maps, because mm-hmm. basically what we did is we took the very best of qualitative methods and intersect that with quantitative methods in order to bring this like really rich, robust data together in a way that we could visually illustrate that would be highly transferable for coaches to be able to look at these different maps and they go, oh yeah, like I see it. And I now know how to take action on that. If I can present scientific findings in a way like that, then we have an opportunity to affect change much more quickly and much more meaningfully, right? It's not common that a coach or that most of the people that are working in sport are going to pick up a peer-reviewed scientific paper and read it, right? And then go, oh, well, now I'm going to like figure out how to implement this. So I think as scientists, as sport scientists, we have to do a better job of finding more innovative and simple ways in which to translate research in a way that makes it easy and palatable and actionable.
Could you tell us a little about how you did a study in basketball and ice hockey in Sweden and what was your findings?
So what we wanted to do in designing this study was we saw the size of Sweden as compared to the United States as an enormous opportunity to get data, get the insights and the ideas from youth ice hockey and basketball players throughout Sweden. So the opportunity to kind of like to do that on a national level and scale is much easier to do in Sweden than it is the United States just because of the size and enormity. And if you consider like the original work that I did was here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, like that's where all of that data comes from. And so in doing the next study in Sweden, I saw it as an opportunity to say, you know, rather than just collecting all our data in Stockholm, for example, let's get data from players like north, south, east and west. So we did a pretty good job of working with both federations to identify clubs and programs throughout the country and do the best that we could in order to stratify the research sample to make sure, okay, you know, let's get as equal numbers of ice hockey and basketball players is equal numbers across girls and boys and younger and older to the extent possible, because we wanted to make sure that at the end of the study that the findings would be as generalizable as possible, right? And that anyone in these sports could have confidence that these data apply to their players. So that was one of sort of the research design aspects that we went about in terms of developing the study. So we really kind of did this in two phases. The first phase was to identify all the determinants that make playing ice hockey and basketball fun. So that was the qualitative portion of the study. So we went throughout the country typically after practices or games and sat with the players and ask them what makes playing these sports fun. Then we take all of that, we transcribe it, and we have the opportunity to then analyze it. And when we did that across the two sports, we identified 84 specific things that make playing ice hockey and basketball fun. And so there is considerable overlap between those findings in Sweden, as well as what we found in the United States and American soccer, was 81 determinants of fun. So in jest, I always say that maybe it's more fun in Sweden.
I was going to say 81 to 84. We must be having a good time over here. 84 sounds like a lot too. Like a lot of factors. I mean, I was trying to think myself when I play sports. 84 things that made it fun. Like that's a lot. I mean, that's interesting.
I mean, to be fair, I think from our perspective as a scientific team, even the first study that we did in the United States in soccer, we were blown away when we were able to extract 81 specific things.
I bet.
Like, I was like, wow, like these players, right? They did an incredible job at their ability to like articulate very precisely, right? What drives this experience of fun for them. And so it was not as surprising, right? Because we had that original data to find that it was very much the same in Sweden as well. You know, some slight differences, but overall, we can say from a cultural standpoint that it's more the same than it is different.
And I was shocked when, you know, hearing that the first time, I was shocked because I would think referring to different cultures, different countries, that it would be very different. Then when I read your findings and, you know, and you'll get to the 11 common aspects of them, the most 11, obviously for someone who works in it, it becomes very clear, like, yeah, this goes hand in hand with self-determination theory and a lot of other theories that would, you know, that are pretty clear cut. So I wasn't as surprised. But if someone was to ask me from the very get-go,
yeah,
do you think there will be differences without seeing the findings? Do you think there'll be differences? I would have said absolutely. So I must admit that I was one of those who, you know, many of the misconceptions of boys and girls or different cultures or different ages, that I would have drawn the assumptions. And I think this is important for our coaches to understand the social assumption that there are differences, whether it be age, whether it be gender, whether it be cultural. We have to really be more critical and really analyze and think at a deeper thought process than just what we've been told for the past life that we've been living as coaches.
Yeah. So the findings, I think, are quite they're quite helpful in giving us, well, an accurate understanding of what fun is, right? And one of the very common misperceptions is that, you know, what drives fun for me is going to be categorically different than what drives fun for you or for Richard. That's kind of the norm in which people kind of think about fun. Right, that it's this very unique experience for each person. And then we then tend to also, along the same sort of norms, we impose certain types of stereotypes onto girls and to boys, that what drives fun for them is going to be, you know, categorically different as well. And oh gosh, most certainly what drives fun for a younger player is going to be different than the older player. Or if we, like in America, which we do so well, is to then, you know, differentiate, you know, playing level, right? And you're like, this pathway or that pathway, right? And it's typically like, you know, the recreational league or the highly competitive select league. Well, the experience of fun must be different. And so what I've come to understand as well is that we make these assumptions, right? And we do so based on maybe in some ways no fault of our own, because we inherently have a bias towards differences. And one of the things that sport does, and it does this for a number of different reasons, right, that are justifiable developmentally, is that we, you know, we categorize players by their age, by their sex, and typically by their skill level, right? That's the way in which we do it, as well as like you play ice hockey or you play basketball. So what science has shown us through scientific study as well is just the mere act of taking a bunch of young people and separating them, right, as we do, leads us to make these just like cognitive errors because we have separated them on this one variable or these three variables in sport. So the mind then leans towards an emphasis on how they're different, not how they're similar. And so even then, when we do find a difference between them, what we do is we define them by that difference. And then we also tend to naturally sort of exploit that in the sense that, like, that's where the focus and emphasis is on. So, and then you kind of think about from a sex and gender standpoint, there are all of these, you know, stereotypes and cultural norms and assumptions. And the various ways in which we then kind of impose those on young people too, mm-hmm. not necessarily consciously, but, you know, this is like that it's part of the culture and the social norms that exist. So we can also do it very unintentionally as well. And so what's really great to see what's come out of the scientific evidence, both, you know, here in the United States, as well as the studies that we have done and will continue to do in Sweden as well, is that all the data is showing that what drives fun for players, whether they are a girl or a boy, they are younger or older, they play at this level or that level, or they play this sport or that sport, that what drives fun is the same. And that really sort of debunks so many of the myths that we hold about what fun is and what it is not, or what it looks and feels like for different people.
Now that we've proven that misconception, which I think is super important for us to underline here, you know, that it is similar. Define fun then for us. What were the findings when you define fun? How would we go about describing it for our coaches?
It's a great question. And if you look at the scientific evidence, right, we're talking about 81 determinants of fun or 84 determinants of fun. It's very rich, it's very robust, and it's super helpful. It's also a lot to hold, right? Mm. So I think most accurately, when you look at all of the data, and no matter which way you look at it, probably the simplest form or the simplest definition, rather, of fun is that fun for players, according to them, is a player-centered athletic development experience. Player-centered athletic development. That alone also debunks the whole idea that fun is goofing off, right? Or that it's free play where there is no structure or goal. The whole concept that it's this like frivolous sort of reward that we give players at the end of practice for being good or getting through what we might call a not fun training session. Here's your reward. Now you get to have fun, right? But it's so counter to what we want and are trying to achieve in sport. And if we look at other types of data that's out there that has studied, you know, Olympians across different quadrenniums, that data also shows that when you ask those Olympians what got them into the sport and why they continue to play their sport, fun is among the top reasons. When you ask them what motivated you to pursue your sport at the highest level, it's because it's fun, right? So fun can't mean goofing off. When you ask players sometimes, or not players, but coaches, like, how would you know that your players are having fun? And they say, oh, well, if they're smiling or they're laughing, they're having fun. But when you look at the data, fun is not measured by laughter and smiles. It's measured by effort. It's measured by learning and improving. It's measured by acquiring a new skill. It's measured by the ability to transfer that new skill into a competitive situation. It's measured by supporting my teammates. It's measured by getting clear, consistent communication and instruction from my coach. It's measured by well-organized practices. It's measured by getting lots of touches on the ball and on the puck. right? It's measured in all of these different ways. One of the ways in which I have tried to also make all of this rich data much more transferable for coaches is to give us an alternative way of kind of thinking about this that's much easier to act on. So if we think about fun, fun we describe as an experience. It's the act of personally encountering or undergoing something. And we think about an experience or how we experience things in the world. We do it through our five senses, right? We have the experiences that we do through touch, through sight, through sound, smell, and taste. If we were to take any one of those five senses away, it alters the experience considerably. When we think about fun as a player experience, and we look at all of this scientific data, and I think it's important to remember that this scientific data is players' ideas and their insights. So if we think about fun as a player experience, and we look at all of this robust data that they have provided, we can take those 84 determinants of fun that they identified in ice hockey and basketball in Sweden, and we can bucket them essentially into what I would call like five senses of fun. Like, how do players experience fun? They experience it through their senses in five different ways: environmentally, physically, verbally, emotionally, and socially. So when we think about, when I say environmentally, we're talking about what is the experience that is constructed on the ice or the court, in the locker room, when traveling, right? The structure, the environmental aspects of the sport. Physically, we're talking about what is the sensory experience created by the tactile, the kinesthetic play that occurs through movement and execution of sport-specific skills. Verbally, we're talking about what is the sensory experience that's created by a coach's words, how they influence a player's hockey knowledge or their IQ. How do their words impact and influence athletic development, a player's motivation? Emotionally, we're talking about the sensory experience of influencing emotions that result from a coach's actions and communication, a teammate's actions and communication, even a parent's, right? So if you kind of think about that ecosystem. And then socially, the sensory experience that's constructed through our relatedness with others, right? Those interactions and those relationships. So if we think about fun as like a five sensory experience through the environment, the physical aspects of the sport, the verbal aspects, the emotional aspects, and then the social aspects, we take those five senses as five elements. We can take the 84 determinants that we've identified and we can basically bucket them across all five. And that's a very, I think, easy way to then kind of, especially for coaches, to kind of think about how they go about creating this experience. So I can't hold 84 things in my head, but I can hold five. I can think about the environment, the physical, the verbal, the emotional, and social. And it's much easier for me to then think about, okay, how do I construct the environment? What makes a well-organized practice? How do I, you know, I construct small-sided games, partner and station-based drills. In the environment, how do I give players some autonomy and voice and choice in what they do and what the practice looks like? From a physical standpoint, if I think about the physical sort of sensory experience of fun, it's much easier for me to remember, right? Like touches on the puck and the ball, as many as possible, right? In small-sided games and things like that, like give them those opportunities. When I think about physically, the kinesthetic, the tactile aspect of what it means to have fun, it means for the players, it means like staying active and being energized and like constantly moving. That's what makes it fun, not standing around and waiting. But it's easier for me to remember those determinants of fun if I think about it just physically, right? There's also a role when you think about the kinesthetic and tactile aspect of of the game that makes it fun, right? High fives and fist bumps, right? That is a tactile, like kinesthetic aspect of the sport. That's also a way to like give encouragement and positive reinforcement, right? That then like influences the emotional part. When we think about verbally, I as a coach, if I think about, okay, the verbal experience for a player, I'm more conscious of thinking about the words that are coming out of my mouth. What am I saying and how am I saying it? How is that going to land and be experienced by the player? Am I communicating in a way that is clear, that is understandable to them? How am I using my words to impart sport-specific knowledge, right? So that they, I'm not just telling them what to do, but they are learning how to do. They are learning how to think critically on their own as well, right? Through like different guided discovery types of tactics. Emotionally, right? When you think about that experience for a player, that helps me sort of understand and think about as a coach the role of active listening. And when I actively listen to the players, how that is experienced for them. My ability to, as a coach, to allow mistakes while still being positive and being encouraging, right? That directly influences the emotional aspect of how the sport is experienced. Being fair and understanding, being easy to talk to, so that sport is, it's not just a physically safe space in which to have fun, but it should also be a psychologically and emotionally safe space in which to experience sport. Socially, if I think about, you know, the final sort of sense of fun, my ability as a coach to encourage collaboration, right? Especially based upon the data that we have in Sweden, where there is this like real emphasis on what drives fun is like doing things together, whether it's winning together or it's losing together, or it's working, you know, on a play together. That is what like really drives the experience. So what am I doing as a coach that helps facilitate that, that helps create that social experience for them, that gives them a sense of team identity, right? What are other things that we can do together, whether it's in the rink or in the arena or outside of that space together, that really kind of builds the social aspect of the sport? So I think kind of conceptualizing fun around these five sort of sensory factors is in some ways maybe a much more practical way to kind of translate this science into practice.
According to the data, what's like the top list of what's to be in sports fun?
Okay. Yeah. So another way to kind of think about this is if we take the 84 determinants of fun, what I just did in the examples that I gave was all of those examples are among those 84 determinants of fun, right? It's just the five senses are a way to kind of conjure them up very easily. Another way is to think about how players, you know, they have sort of in some ways like taken the 84 determinants and put them into themes. We can break it down into 11 specific factors. And that's what we have found in American soccer, as well as Swedish ice hockey and basketball, is that these, whether it's 81 determinants of fun or it's 84 determinants of fun, they fall into these 11 factors. And so the first is positive team dynamics, or what's also called good team togetherness. The second is trying hard. The third is positive coaching or a good coach. The fourth is learning and improving. The fifth is team friendships. The sixth is mental bonuses. Seven and eight are games and practice. Nine is game time support. 10 is team rituals. And 11 is swag. And so what we have found is that there is a sort of higher and lower order structure to these 11 in terms of importance. And what tends to drive fun the most is trying hard, positive coaching or a good coach, and positive team dynamics or good team togetherness. At the bottom are team rituals and swag, and then the others, learning and improving, team friendships, mental bonuses, games and practice, and game time support are kind of in that secondary tier. So when we really kind of think about this, if we were even to just like typically look at, you know, what's in the top tier, trying hard, positive team dynamics, and positive coaching.
What's in positive coaching?
Positive coaching is cuts across many of the examples that I gave when I kind of talked about it from a five sensory experience, right? So a coach that knows a lot about the sport, a coach that allows mistakes and continues to stay positive and encouraging, a coach that communicates clearly and concisely and consistently. A coach that communicates in a way that's easily understandable, a coach that is easy to talk to and approach. These are the different ways in which the players define positive coaching. So I think, you know, you ask a very important question, Richard, which is, okay, positive coaching, right? We could give our own, you know, sort of definition of what we think that is, but it's really important to go back to the determinants that define positive coaching, what that looks like according to players. In the research, we have, you know, in Sweden, we have the 84 determinants that have been bucketed into these 11 sort of higher order factors. And one of the things that I have found over the years in presenting the science and also doing coach education workshops and clinics is that presenting the 84 specifically and even the 11 fun factors, the ones that we just went over, 11 is still a lot to hold. It's super helpful to know from a scientific standpoint. I think the challenge still is how do we figure out a way to translate this more simply for coaches so that they can act on? And that's why I presented it in terms of like the sensory experience, because it's very easy to just say, okay, how do I create that experience? Okay, I remember there's five senses of fun. I can remember those five. And by asking myself, how do I do that? It's much easier for me to remember the different 84 determinants that fall into those five senses than it is for me to remember, okay, what are the 11 factors? And then how are each of them defined? It's a more practical, I think, tool in terms of how to take the science and start to translate it into the sports space in a meaningful way that's easier to do. But at its core, again, I cannot emphasize this enough, is that what makes basketball and ice hockey and soccer fun is player-centered athletic development. And I think when we think about the word player-centered athletic development, it's not meant to communicate me specifically. Yes, my athletic development. But what the data shows us is that my athletic development is a product of not just my individual effort, right? Trying hard, which is a big part of having fun for players. But it is also a product of what my coaches do, the experience that they provide for me, positive coaching, a good coach. It is also a product of what my teammates do, right? And how they contribute, how I contribute to positive team dynamics, right? Which they define as like working well together, collaborating together, supporting one another. So it is this sort of like, another way to kind of think about it is that there is this whole ecosystem, right? And everyone that is in that sport ecosystem, whether we're talking about basketball or ice hockey or soccer or tennis, plays a role in creating that fun experience.
And I think you said something interesting when we talked before the episode. You said something about, because some say that, yeah, it should be fun, but it's also fun to win. So like, and of course it's fun to win together, but you also said that some findings show that the players also think it's fun to lose together. That thing was a little bit interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think that's one of the key differences that we found in the data between the study that we did in soccer in the United States and then ice hockey and basketball in Sweden was that in Sweden, there is this sort of overwhelming emphasis on togetherness and doing things together that we didn't necessarily see in the soccer data, which culturally, I think, makes a whole lot of sense given the individualism and the value that Americans hold around that. So the players talked about like, yeah, winning is fun, right? Losing did not come up as fun. However, when you look at what the players in Sweden said is like, yes, winning is fun, but they said winning together. And they always said winning together. They also said losing together. So I think for everyone out there, there's an important lesson here is that it's not so much the outcome of the game, but the experience of the game, how they shared in that together. And so you can have one of your best games and you could have learned the most and developed the most and tried the hardest. And ultimately, like the team may have lost, but because the score of the game meant that your team lost shouldn't take away from the quality of the experience that you had. And so I think what's really important to understand here is that players are saying that you can have fun even if the outcome of the game is a loss. And the outcome of that game and losing is something that we shared together that made it fun. And so another way to kind of think about this, I think that might be easier to kind of sort of wrestle with this finding, which can, you know, take people by surprise at first, is that, yeah, winning is fun, right? And we know that winning, having more pucks, right, in the net or balls through the net, like that is the objective of the game that you are playing. And that when that happens, when we win, if you think about like the images that come to mind, what that looks like and how that is celebrated, that is an experience that is probably from an arousal level is an experience at a high activation level. But having the shared experience of playing a really good and really hard game, because the other thing to remember is that what also drives fun for players is that they play evenly matched games. So being challenged, that also is what makes it fun. And they can have that experience and still ultimately lose the game. But if they've done that together, right, that is still fun. It's probably not experienced at the same physiological arousal level as winning, right? So as an activation level, it's experienced lower, but it is still fun.